Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me, as always, there is Nick Newman.
Howdy.
Howdy. And today, to help us talk about Sicario, which I assume is the way that is pronounced, coming from RogerEbert.com, it is Scout Tafoya.
Hello.
Did I pronounce that correctly?
You did.
Sweet. That is one of those things that I probably asked before. Yeah, do we know how to pronounce this? Is it Sicario? Is it Sicario? Is it...
No, I think it's
Sicario. I think it's Sicario. I think if... Twitter being what it is, if somebody knew and we were all getting it wrong, they would have said something.
That's true. There would have been a joke. There would
Right. It was like how-ha.
Film Twitter would have been a buzz with the correct pronunciation of Sicario.
As it so frequently can be.
We're still trying to figure out how to pronounce Smaug.
You know, and yet there hasn't been some blowback, or at least there hasn't been a contingent of people giving the proper pronunciation for Charlie Kaufman's new movie. Because I was reading it as Anomalisa.
It's Anomalisa, right?
It's Anomalisa, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Like an anomaly, right?
Whose name is Lisa?
Sure.
That's what I presume he's going.
Yeah,
for.
No, I mean, right? Yeah, no, I certainly assume so. But you know, who knows?
No, it took me like a good 5 minutes of reading that over and over to finally be like, oh, I get it. Probably.
I mean, he did it to us last time with Synecdoche, New York. So it's not like he's a stranger to making everybody furious.
Synecdoche, New York.
Yeah, and just Schenectady as well, which right. Many people were just
so many,
oh no,
so many levels.
That's right. You're like, oh, that's not a word. He means the place.
Oh, man. All right. Well, we're not here to talk about difficult-to-pronounce movies. We're here to talk about Sicario. The newest film from Denis Villeneuve. Again, not hard to pronounce at all. I think we've all settled on that being how we say it.
It sounds the most French, so I like it.
Yeah, that's. I just kind of try to think, like, if I were to pronounce that like a stereotypical French person, mm-hmm. like Joseph Gordon-Levitt in The Walk, how would you pronounce it?
If so, you had terrifying eyebrows, how would you say this?
You are so stuck on those eyebrows.
Hey, man, they're stuck on me.
Like
anyway.
Stuck on Joseph Gordon-Levitt. All right. Anyway, so today we will just be talking about Sicario. Before we get into it, allow me to remind everyone that you should rate us on iTunes, give us a comment, give us a rating, email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com. Feel free to comment on the page that this has been posted on thefilmstage.com, and follow us on Twitter at @filmstageshow. But that is it. And we're not talking about anything else but Sicario, so let's dive right in. Sicario is, as we said, the newest film from director Denis Villeneuve. It stars Emily Blunt, Josh Brolin, and Benicio Del Toro. And it is about an FBI agent, Kate Macer, played by Emily Blunt, who is brought into a special task force whose job it is to... They say a bunch of really cool stuff related to what their job is without ever actually saying what their job is. Make a lot of noise to dramatically overreact.
Make a lot of noise. That's my favorite one. That's my favorite like thing that screenwriters do to get around the fact that they have no specialized knowledge is they ask somebody to like put it in simple terms.
Yeah.
It's very much the Jeremy Irons in a Margin Call moment where he says, "Explain it to me as if I were a tiny dog." And it's like, you know, if he had founded this company, he wouldn't need you to explain it to him like that. He'd know what you were talking about.
At least in this movie, there is a reason for their dissembling, which we'll get into. So before we do that, here is the trailer for Sicario.
State Department is pulling an agent that specializes in responding to escalated cartel activity.
This is not my department.
FBI!
be a part of this.
Do we get an opportunity at the men responsible for today?
The men who are really responsible for today.
Ever met the Juarez before?
We're going to El Paso, right? You're not American. What do you work for now?
Well, I go where I'm sent.
So that is the trailer for Sicario. And, yeah, let's just dive right in and talk about it.
Well, I think the first thing to say, as you can hear from the trailer, is that the soundtrack is amazing. And, yeah, and sort of more skewed towards the overly horrific and spooky than you come to expect from movies about the drug war. I mean, there's always been a sort of, I don't know, playing, especially the sort of south of the border drug stuff for, like, horror, but this feels like a very overtly kind of, I don't know, it's got an almost like dystopian sci-fi thing going on, and it works beautifully.
Yeah, it definitely does. This movie has an almost omnipresent drum beat behind it that seems to fade in and out, almost in the way that a shark's fin would break the surface of the water.
100%. It feels,
it's beautiful.
It feels like they slowed something down in kind of that Inception way, but in a smarter and more insidious kind of fashion. And it sort of does the over aestheticizing that I think Villeneuve typically is guilty of for him, which is interesting. The cinematography doesn't really have that kind of intensity that he usually brings to this stuff. Like, I was sort of expecting the whole movie to be yellow after Enemy, but the score kind of turns it yellow for you, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I could get behind that. I wouldn't mind another movie that looked like Enemy, in all honesty.
Neither would I frankly. Love that. Yeah, it was like Steven Soderbergh doing Cronenberg. Steven Cronenberg? Anyway. No, I thought Enemy was delightful. And I don't know. I loved his very deliberate refusal to explain anything that you had just seen. And I kind of wish that if I have a complaint about Sicario, it's that he does not do the same thing. He does not throw his defenses up when it comes time to explain what's happening. And I walked away with a little more information and a little more kind of screenwritery covering up of everything than I had just seen.
This movie does have a little more of first-time screenwriter's disease, which is fine because I believe it was written by a first-time screenwriter. And it does still leave enough kind of out in the open. I mean, nothing is going to end with the what-the-hell moment that Enemy had.
No, of course not.
Especially not a movie like this, so I'm fine with that. This is a good point for me to plug that sometime in the not-too-distant future, I'll actually be posting on the film stage a video essay that looks at Enemy and the themes inside of it. So keep an eye out for that, ladies and gentlemen at home.
That sounds exciting.
Yeah. All right. Nick Newman, what were your kind of broad general thoughts on Sicario? And do you agree with the small amount of gushing that we've already done?
Well, I saw Sicario on Sunday, and I feel like, and I addressed this when we reviewed Enemy about a year and a half ago, but Denis Villeneuve has become one of those directors who I feel as if doesn't really get a fair shake, which feels a bit silly to say because he's obviously a director who the right people are taking an interest in. The right people if you want to have a career, that is, because he's getting to make these movies. He's getting talented people involved with them. I mean, for God's sake, Ridley Scott handed him the keys to a Blade Runner sequel that Harrison Ford is going to be in. So obviously, he's getting a fair shake in some sense. But something about him, I feel like maybe we can discuss this later. I feel like we should discuss this later. Inspires a real vitriol in certain people because they seem to feel that he represents a kind of, I don't want to say an easy option, but I think that a film such as Ansan Dee, his 2010 Oscar nominee, represents to a lot of people kind of an overly aestheticized, thematically hollow foreign export that should be sort of pushed back against, and that maybe when he's coming into Hollywood and he's sort of being given all these opportunities, you know, there's cause for concern. And so some people say that. Some people I know and whose taste I trust say that they think Prisoners is one of the worst films they've ever seen. They think that Enemy is this sort of overly aestheticized, ultimately thin, faux sci-fi treatise. People get mad about Denis Villeneuve, which I find odd because although I'm not his greatest fan, I think he's certainly talented, and I think he's talented in ways that are just the traditional ways a director can be talented, in that he can compose a nice shot, and he can make good use of his cinematographers and his actors, and he can, despite often choosing screenplays that are a bit too wordy and a bit too explanation-heavy, he can tell stories with his images, silently. Sicario has that, I think, in spades, perhaps more than most of his other work, at least more than Prisoners, which really gets hampered down by, I think, a just abysmal second half. I mean, I think Prisoners, I like that film, but I also think it's head-smackingly stupid in a way that's actually kind of special. I mean, it doesn't make it good, but when I won't spoil it for those who haven't seen it, but you know, when a certain late in the game twist happens and when snakes are coming out of a box, I kind of go, okay, this is reaching it like a new Rubicon of stupidity for me.
But anyway, I loved that part of that film.
I confess,
the snakes in the box.
I also love the snakes in the box.
Yeah,
it's fun, but it's also really dumb. Anyway,
it's that not to. I mean, we've talked about Prisoners on this podcast, and I remember, Nick, I think you and I both had the initial uncertainty about it because there's a opening shot where it's someone praying in the
Lord's Prayer.
Then and like, it, doesn't the camera just like sometimes just moves in on trees?
Well, it's a close up, not a close up, but it's a, say, a full body medium shot of a deer, and then it pulls back as Hugh Jackman recites the Lord's Prayer, and finally we settle on the barrel of a rifle,
right,
which fires and kills the deer. And I said, I still remember to a certain degree that episode where I said, within those first moments, I went, "Whoa, Buster, slow down. We're just getting started. It's all right. You can ease into this." So anyway.
Right, but I firmly remember that I had that same reaction, and then later on when there was like a tree in front of a house and they just kind of pushed in on it.
Luckily,
I feel like he's pared back on that.
It does. Well, the thing is, what I was about to say, what I was seconds away from saying, is that Sicario opens in a similar sense in that, you know, it opens on Emily Blunt looking like she really has to go to the bathroom. The expression on her face is just, when does this meeting end so I can run to the toilet? And they're in a, she's with a SWAT team. They're in a van. The van backs up into a house. It destroys the front of the house, as so often happens when a SWAT van backs up in front of it. And then they discover, after a brief shootout, these bodies inside the wall in a very gruesome setting, as is often the case when bodies are found on a wall. And then this shed blows up. Some people are killed. It's a very ugly scene, and it looks ugly intentionally. So the aestheticization of it is ugly. It is a pretty... The movie is staking its claim early that this is going to be not only a brutal experience in terms of violence, but it's also going to have a lot of oppressiveness to it. Aesthetically, you might admire it, but you're not necessarily going to have a good time with it. And laying its cards out on the table like that, I found very admirable. And the film is going along, and one of the things that I am appreciating about it most is that although Emily Blunt is, for all intents and purposes, the lead, this film is at times like a pulpier and, you know, pulpier South of the Border version of The Wire, in that there isn't really a main character. It is sort of bouncing around between both her compatriots and people on the other side. And the sort of this oscillation in focus between sides and sort of the jumping around within those, I found pretty compelling, partly because I was constantly kept on my toes and I wasn't exactly sure who we're going to, why we're going to them. The movie made me kept asking that, as opposed to kind of feeling exasperated, you know, wanting to spend a lot of time with Emily Blunt, who I think is great. You know, she's, you know, it's not exactly difficult to look at her, you know. So when she's on screen, I mean, no, but seriously, I mean, she's a very beautiful woman. So when she's on screen, I'm not exactly minding her presence, even though in this movie, I think she's a bit misused as someone who is very kind of serious and dour, because I think she has.
Well, if she's misused, I'd say in her defense that she takes to the character with sort of uncommon perception about how somebody this tightly wound would behave. There wasn't a moment that I didn't believe that she was this person.
It's I believed it in scenes where she wasn't directly in combat, and then this is kind of a problem I had with Edge of Tomorrow, which is that for some reason I just don't quite buy her as an action star. I feel like...
I don't think she's an action star either. I think she does fine in action movies, but I think the idea that she's going to be the only... And she even has said this, how absurd it is, that because she carried a gun in one movie, that now she's going to carry a gun in all movies, because that's a safer bet than seeing if other women work in male movies.
Well, here they're going to do the opposite of what Spielberg did in E.T., and they're actually going to go back and put a gun into her hand in the
But... But the thing is, when she's in those scenes, I guess what I'm saying is that I feel like this very kind of Villeneuve-esque performance doesn't quite fit her. And I felt that more and more as... Well, no, Villeneuve-esque, because there is sort of a brand of performance from him, I think. If you look at the two leads in Prisoners, if you look at, I guess the two leads in Enemy / both Gyllenhaals, it's kind of this very, it's kind of tightly wound, always on the edge of kind of bursting into some extreme reaction. And so as the movie is going along and it's sort of going further and further into the shit of the drug war, I guess I found it a bit less compelling because there was this sense that the movie can do other things, but it sort of more and more becomes one thing as it goes along. And then it inevitably, I kind of felt these little avenues that the movie was exploring otherwise closing. And it just becomes more and more a film about the war on drugs, albeit in a different way, a way that we don't necessarily see, still a movie about the war on drugs. And then there's this, I don't want to say diversion because I did just praise it using its cast in many ways, but there is a section involving Benicio del Toro at the end that I guess I found less compelling because it sort of turns him into a super soldier in a way that kind of... One of the things I like about Benicio del Toro is that he really looks like a real guy. And so when he's playing someone such as this agent who wears a suit while he's torturing somebody, I completely believe it. But when he's wearing the Kevlar, all black gloves, has a silencer pistol, it feels sort of...
It feels
like he's wearing a costume.
Yeah, it feels like a movie. And that is the problem with that section of the film. And that's... I understand exactly what you're saying, that it becomes one kind of movie, that essentially it gives you the impression when you're starting that you're going to hop with Emily Blunt from one horrific scene to the next until she says uncle. But that does not wind up being what it is, kind of. I mean, it sort of does, but not really. It sort of puts her in direct confrontation with the Del Toro character.
Now, this is funny because it seems, Nick, like you have a problem with this movie and what it does with Benicio at a certain point, in the same way that you had a problem with Prisoners once the snakes hit, which is, and I think it's, I'm going to say this, it's Villeneuve's fault. Because he makes movies that for the first, half to three quarters feel very much like, a Traffic in this case, or, in the case of Prisoners, your typical kind of Oscar bait, like heavy emotions. Maybe there's not going to be a lot of plot. Maybe it's not going to mean anything, but you're going to be in with these characters. And towards the end, he loves to rip it back into pulp.
Yeah.
It's crazy. In the way that he kind of gut punched everyone in the last literally 5 seconds of Enemy, at some point he says in Prisoners, this police procedural suburban domestic drama bores me. I'm going to bring in mazes and snakes. Uh-huh. And in this movie, he says, okay, this semi-realistic look at drug violence is kind of boring me. I'm going to turn it into, and I don't want to say precisely what it is, but, a more pulpy filmic thriller. And with that. I have no problem with that.
I think that, to go back to what Nick was saying about, the vitriol that he provokes in people, I think the word that you were kind of dancing around is that he can get incredibly pretentious. And I don't mind that, which is maybe my own failing as a critic, that I occasionally like it when people get pretentious, but only because I would say he can aesthetically back it up. That's the only reason. Like, if Prisoners was made by a less exacting stylist, it would be terrible. It would
yeah,
be like,
if Rennie Harlan made Prisoners.
Right. It would be Mindhunters. But so, like, but I think that what we're saying is that he's got that old-fashioned French, in this case French-Canadian, but still that kind of, this material is terrible, but it doesn't matter. I can transform it because I'm talented. Like,
he's the auteur.
Exactly. He's like, I'm reminded, and I quote this all the time now because I just got through the Stanley Kaufman anthology, but he talked about in Mississippi Mermaid about how arrogant he thought Francois Truffaut was, that he could take this thing that he clearly looked down upon and sort of turn it into a Truffaut film as opposed to just make it work on its own merits as a story. And so in that sense, he kind of sands off all the dramatic tension trying to make it that thing and fit into his box instead of make it work as a movie. And I think the Villeneuve is hella guilty of that. I mean, you know, Ansandis is like ground zero for his abominable narrative practices because it looks for all the world like, you know, the saddest, you know, road movie of all time. And then at the end, it becomes like 1,000 times worse than that when you figure out what you've actually been looking at the whole time. And you're like, oh, okay, thank you for that. And, you know, I think that he loves that, and he loves the idea that you think you're watching one kind of serious drama, and then instead you're watching something that's like 10 times grosser. And I don't know, I should be more offended by it, but I'm not.
So one last thing I want to say before I can finally hand off to someone else is that, for me, the problem is that it feels as if this in Prisoners, kind of what they do is they take a step forward, they progress, they take a step forward, and then they shuffle to the side. Whereas something like Enemy, the very odd pieces of that, the very unexpected pieces of that, feel as if they're sort of growing from the previous scenes. There's a very chartable progression going on there, whereas I think Sicario is kind of a bit more jagged. Now, I don't inherently mind that because a lot of movies I like, even a lot of movies I love, have that jagged quality. Mm-hmm. But something about it here feels a bit, it feels a bit more inelegant. Even the way that the style of the way the film is photographed changes, it seems as if it's kind of trying to have it a couple of ways when really, I think the one way it was going to was interesting and varied enough. So ultimately, I did like the film, and I think it is worth seeing, but I say so with recommendations. For me, you know, if I were to grade it on a letter scale, it would be a light B. But I also, maybe it doesn't help that about 75 minutes into the movie, I started to get a migraine. And I actually looked at my phone when I felt it coming on because I was thinking, okay, at what point am I starting to feel this? And then it's that feeling of someone, you know, scraping a piece of brush inside my head behind my right eye. And I'm just thinking, okay. And then I'm kind of watching half the movie.
Is this caused by the movie or is this just something you struggle with?
Unfortunately, it's often just something I struggle with. Okay. And so, but I never have it. For some reason, I've been fortunate enough not to have it during a movie. Maybe, I mean, the film was pretty loud, so maybe it was caused by that. But I've actually felt that pretty much as soon as I got outside, it was kind of that post-migraine, semi-orgasmic chill in the back of the neck.
Learning so just, much about Nick Newman right now.
Yeah, where you just kind of go. A lot of information.
Yeah. But I wish the film was more semi-orgasmic. Than the migraine, okay. But what can you do? Anyway,
no, I would say this is one of the worst films you could watch with a headache. The sound design, as good as it is just going to make that worse.
I would say that the lighting in some of the scenes would too.
No,
in a good 100%. Way.
You yeah, know, sure.
The desert sun will scorch your eyes, but it's beautiful as long as you can stand to stare at it.
Right.
I mean, the opening scene where they're in the van and the kind of the blades of light through the windows are moving, even as everyone else is standing completely still, is just gorgeous, just beautiful. And I don't know how talking about Nick's migraine suddenly got me talking about the use of light in this film. Scout, any responses to Nick? Any things you want to add of your own?
Well, I mean, here's the thing is that And this has been my experience with him as long as I've been watching his movies. I have not seen Polytechnique or any of his short work, which I understand is there's at least a few of those. But I agree, and this is the most perplexing thing about him. I agree with every single criticism that you have for his work, but he, I don't know, has this like visual confidence that makes me just sort of shut that off. And I'm like, well, yeah, you're right. This is really stupid, but I don't care.
I think a lot of that goes into the fact that his directorial style applies to both weird genres that he's like mashed together.
Right.
It helps to ground one and elevate the other.
Mm-hmm.
And it just weirdly works. I mean, as Nick was talking about how Enemy seems to, its weirdness grows from out of it.
Right.
You know, it makes a lot of sense. It's like if you started, you know, noticing that you had a sore and then suddenly the next day there was a hand where there shouldn't have been a hand on your body. You're like, okay, well,
that makes
unwanted
sense.
You know, really weird, but I can see where that came from.
Right. I should have gone to the doctor.
Right. And the last two films, it's like if you're walking down the street and suddenly the entire city burst into song. It's just like, well, now I don't have any idea where I am.
Right, exactly, exactly. Yeah, and that's, you know, as soon as it was over, and I remember I remember talking to Callum Marsh and Tina Hassania about Villeneuve because he had made Enemy in Toronto, and he had made it a very Toronto film in a way that I don't think many people do. I think basically he and Adam McGoyan are the only people who shoot Toronto as Toronto. You know, talking about this and then them both saying like, we couldn't stand Prisoners. And so when they saw Sicario, I asked Callum, had he gotten the stupid out of his system? And he was like, oh no, absolutely not. But it's still a worthwhile experience. You know, I'm you know, clearly paraphrasing, but you know, that's the thing is that he's so good at what he does that I believe he has blinders to the things that he is terrible at, which is editing the screenplays that he's got. You know, when Sicario ended and I realized everything that it had done wrong, I was like, well, does that ultimately get in the way of my enjoyment of the experience of watching it? And it's one of those things where in 10 years, I'll remember the shot of the Marines descending into the cave when the sun is going down, and I will remember that music as Emily Blunt is going into the tunnel, and I'll remember every single little tick and movement that Benicio del Toro does. But the thing that I will hopefully have forgotten is just how dumb some of the dialogue is, and you know what a conventional film it turns out to be by the end of it, no matter how sort of cutthroat it was in getting there. So I guess the thing to do at this point is to just talk about what a truly amazing performance Benicio del Toro gives, and why haven't we put his face on money yet?
Because no one would be brave enough to use money anymore.
They wouldn't want to give away their sweet Benicios. No, I think he's amazing. He always has been. I think he's our Robert Mitchum, if Ricardo Darín can't be said to already be our Robert Mitchum. But this performance really, really goes a long way towards reminding you why we loved him so much in the first place, because he's been gone for so long. I don't even remember, other than maybe that disastrous Wolfman movie or his two-second cameo in Somewhere, the last time I saw him in something. Maybe because he was choosing less interesting films that quite knew what to do with his, you know, incredibly specific brand of charisma. I guess he was in Savages, wasn't he?
He was in, oh God, Savages.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, he was in Savages. I'm looking at his IMDb now. He was in Inherent Vice, which
I've
forgotten about.
Oh, yeah. Not long enough, that's why.
And Guardians of the Galaxy.
Ugh, well.
Yeah, I know. It's not ideal, but it's what it is.
I guess we take him where we can get him. This performance was just, and they dressed him just perfectly, because the whole time he's got this suit that's on just tight enough that you're like, what is he concealing? Like, what secrets does his body possess? Like, he's just, every move was honest and true, and his voice sort of never got away from him, even when he's sort of tormenting people, and that odd thing he does with his legs when he's interrogating, like, it's, yeah, this, if I hadn't just seen Cate Blanchett in Carol, I'd say it was performance of the year.
I gotta see Carol, because I'm sick and tired of hearing people talk about how good it is.
It's, I mean, yeah, have me back on when you do that, would you? Because I could gush about that film forever.
I have. I was hanging out with some friends over the weekend, and they kept talking about these wonderful stores that they'd been to. One of them was like a tobacco shop. The other was a whiskey store. And that's how I feel about Carol, because like they couldn't remember where the stores were or even what their names were. So it's like, here, let me describe this beautiful, wonderful place that you'll never get to go. I'm just like, great. So I have that in movie form with Carol, apparently.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at least you know when it'll be open, right? Yeah,
someday.
You just need directions at that point. Nick, were you going to say something just now?
No, just that Carol's pretty good.
God damn it.
Scout and I saw it in the same theater, so we should know.
That's right.
Nick, like sent out a series of tweets about like just the lighting and the tactility of, I don't know, you used a lot of big words. I can't remember.
It's going to be a real toss-up between Ed Lachman lighting Carol and Roger Deakins lighting Sicario, because
I'm team Carol. So, not that I, you know, not that they're really doing the same thing. I mean, they're pretty different.
No, well, not
movies,
at all. But that's exactly, that's my point, is that the cinematography, I think, is funneled in two extremely opposing directions. That essentially Sicario has this bare, you know, harsh,
bleach,
you've kind of got these empty, gross rooms and the dust coming in through the windows and everything. And meanwhile, Carol is this very soft, sort of grimily nostalgic photography. I don't know why we keep talking about Carol. This is not the subject of this podcast. I hope you know that you brought me on here just to derail the conversation with tangents.
Imagining now a movie called Sicario.
I would watch that. You know I would. The Deakins photography is great in that way of his, because it's not showy. You know, like No Country for Old Men, like his other work for Villeneuve, it's exactly what it needs to be, but it doesn't make, you know, it doesn't make a fuss over itself, as a lot of cinematographers can frequently do. I'm thinking specifically of Bruno Delbonnel, who, while good, really likes patting himself on the back with his lighting.
I was going to say Janusz Kaminski.
Yeah, 100%.
Cannot wait to see all the shiny windows and lens flares and Bridge of Spies.
That's this Sunday. Looking forward to it.
Yeah. I think I'm seeing that some point next week. I can't remember. It's weird. I mean, I understand the crazy turn that this movie takes, but I loved it. And I can't refer to anything that happens in this movie as like a mistake or a disappointment or a problem.
Well,
because it just works together in this very bizarre, you know, organic in an alien way that I like.
I guess, you know, there in hindsight, when you look at, for instance, Traffic and its kind of Reefer Madness approach to the teenage daughter runaway story, like that's pretty dumbly Hollywood, but Soderbergh sells it with his, you know, fantastically precise images and everything. And that movie was, you know, I assume a lot of that was, you know, the post-production DI and stuff like that he was able to get that incredibly precise look that way. And nobody had seen anything quite like that before. So I think that maybe that had the edge that you could forgive a lot of its shortcomings because it didn't really look like anything else. This, again, doesn't really look or move quite like anything that wasn't already directed by Denis Villeneuve. But, you know, after 15 years of drug war movies, it's, you know, I think that people who think they can get around the cliches by retreating into other cliches are kidding themselves. Let me ask you this, though. If the film had less of a conventional ending, would you like it more? Would you like it the same? I mean, is that too abstract or hypothetical?
I mean, in a way, I don't find the ending to be that conventional. And this will be something we can rock into when we're in spoilers in a little bit. But I feel like the ending with Benicio's character and then the ending with Emily Blunt's character have enough of a dichotomy between them that it doesn't strike me as your usual sort of like Zero Dark Thirty, oh, war is hell, and was it really worth it type of ending. because right. it doesn't become about what they've done. It's become the reasons that they've done them. Mm-hmm. And the fact that it focuses more on that and makes people really ask the question, are you willing to pay the lingering price for what you've done? Not just can you live with what you've done? Like, will you continue to live as this person and, you know, hold yourself to the same standards? That's the type of thing that I love. And I okay. feel like this movie, my girlfriend and I afterwards were talking about it, and we tried to say, like, well, what if this character had done...
Brian, I have a girlfriend.
good to know you're still around, Nick. When we get
Are you guys usually this petty?
We're usually a lot more petty. Okay. When we get into spoilers, actually, there's my girlfriend had a funny reaction in a way that, I mean, it was absolutely terrifying. But no, when we were talking about it, we kept saying, like, what if this person had done something else rather than what they've done? And it was difficult for us to conceptualize that, because the characters were drawn or at least acted well enough that everything they did made sense. And there was only really one moment where we felt it could have gone either way, and we would have been happy with it either way. But right. given the way it went, I'm being so obtuse right now.
I completely understand what you're saying, because for so much of the film, he sort of cultivates this incredible sense of overwhelming confusion. And I think that is something he does really well and needs to explore further. The idea that he's sitting there with his camera with Emily Blunt's character, essentially watching all of this stuff happening and being utterly powerless to change or control even a single aspect of it.
Right.
And
at that point,
when
the only thing
decides...
That...
Oh, sorry.
I was going to say, the only thing that going. She can yeah. really control at that point is her moral stance.
Right.
And she does, yes. up until the point that it might cost her something. And that's Correct. When she really has to... That would be her heroic moment that everyone else in the movie gets all the time, because they know what they're doing and why they're doing it. And she is literally just a pawn.
Right. But I think that what's interesting is, and maybe you guys felt differently, I don't necessarily think the film treats anybody as a hero.
Oh, no, absolutely.
And okay, yeah. And I think that, you know, the point made earlier about this sort of being the wire where you're seeing both sides of it, if anything, I had a huge problem with the one point of view character we get on the other side of the border, which is the crooked cop. Because that to me felt, again, like this incredibly heavy-handed device that he's so fond of, which is like, you know, I can't even imagine what he thought audiences were going to get out of this character, which is essentially like, hey, look, he's got a family too. Like, as opposed to all these other people they're murdering all the time.
Well, what I thought was interesting about that character is the fact that he's the only one who does have a family.
Well, he's the only one that you see who has a family.
Right. But Macer doesn't seem to have a family. Josh Brolin's character, Matt, doesn't have a family.
You don't
know
that they don't have families. They just don't say anything about it. I mean, that's the difference, is that if you had just seen that character at work, you would also not know he had a kid. You know, when he says, the whole point of that seemed to be that when he says, I have a family, please don't kill me, we in the audience know, yeah, that's true, he doesn't. Like,
I think that what I personally thought the movie was doing is, we're seeing these people in the way that they spend the bulk of their time and what's perhaps most important to them. Macer is at work. You know, Benicio del Toro's character of Alejandro is at work. Matt is at work. And no, they never talk about their family life. If someone were pointing a gun at them, they wouldn't even bring up their family. And this guy is at home, usually asleep and drunk because of what he's having to do on his job. But it's what you identify yourself with. And the three American, well, two American and one shady background character very heavily identify themselves with what they're doing in terms of their professional lives. And this man, you know, he's going along to get along because he has a family, because he has a wife and a son. And I feel like that's what the movie was showing us, is that there are the professionals and then there are the people kind of caught up in it because that just happens to be what their job is.
Everybody keeps saying, I'm a professional. I'm sick of hearing that. I'm a professional. Anyway?
I'm trying to remember what that's from.
Come on. It's not so many degrees removed, although I would rather watch that movie again than this. Come on. I'm a professional. Everybody keeps saying that I'm a professional. I'm fucking sick of that. I'm a professional. Come on. Okay, words appearing on the screen.
I know it's not in English.
No, it's in English, but the words appear on the screen, and that's part of why. Okay, color filters changing.
Man on Fire.
Yeah.
Duh, yeah.
this is the trivia break normally part of the episode structure.
I could see someone angrily saying that as they were like hitting someone in the head with something. Yeah, I remember. Right. That.
So, one thing I want to say about this movie. Well, I guess. Well, I want to follow up a point that Mr. Tafoya made about the sort of reductiveness and repetitiveness, needlessness, et cetera, of showing the guy's family. I do agree that, you know, him sitting there, you know, with his son, just a little boy, doesn't know any better about what his pop does. Okay.
With the AK-47 propped up against his bedside.
Yeah, it feels very, you know... It feels very kind of high school student screenplay in a way. Mm-hmm. But I do like the way that it leads up to, and I don't want to spoil it when I say the final scene, but the way it leads up to, I won't say what the final scene is, but the way it leads up to the final scene, and particularly how the title card comes into play, the way that this is the first time in a while I've been really surprised by a title card in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the way it comes up actually has a thematic significance, which is funny because the next day I saw at the New York Film Festival Zhou Zhenke's new movie Mountains Made Apart, and that also uses a title card in a very interesting way. Those two movies back to back. 45 minutes into the movie. Both of those I was thinking, you know what, guys being everyone else, do better. Do better with your title cards. So the way that it builds toward that, I guess I can kind of forgive it because in retrospect... what I'm thinking about most is that unsettling scene involving gunfire and glances and a title that the movie starts with, but then it only kind of comes back around at the very end to make it whole. Finally, the word Sicario is kind of presented in its fullness. You see it only for what it is. And I think there's a real intelligence in that. I think it's often kind of groan-inducing when a movie has a foreign-sounding title. I mean, if it opens with the card saying, in Spanish, the card means hitman, at that moment I kind of went, all right. Because it seems sort of, again, it seems pretentious. Poor. I mean, I don't like the word pretentious at all. I would say it seems portentous. It seems, you know, it's trying to say, get ready, portentous? Guys. Is it portentous or portentous?
I believe it's tentous.
I thought it was pretentious.
No?
Portent...
Somebody with a keyboard better Google this, or we are going to look like a pack of fools.
I am looking it up right now.
Oh,
shit, it's portentous.
Shit.
Nailed it.
Damn it.
Fuck.
I've been looking like an idiot for so long. Why did no one ever correct me?
It should be pronounced, but let's be fair, it should be pronounced portentous. Anyway.
I agree, yeah.
It's like proscribed and prescribed, yeah.
Let's say the portent of that, I kind of... That I sort of like more than the presumptuousness or the presumptuousness, however that word might actually be pronounced, because now I don't know. Yeah. So sort of the wraparound quality of that, I think it's more of a destination than a journey kind of thing for me, is all. But
okay.
I'm really curious now what the Google image search result for portentous is. And one is a cartoon of a lion chasing a zebra. It looks like it was made in sort of like a clip art thing. Another is a wolf wearing a sort of a 1920s gangster suit, holding a cane with a diamond on top of it. Another is a
symbols of. Another is a
drawing of the father from the Lion King.
I was about to say I just looked it up, and yeah, there's Mufasa. Then there's a black cat under two black clouds. I guess this is a... you know what? This is... what are we talking about? Let's...
okay.
Let's
get...
The film is rife with portents.
So, actually, yes. Amazingly, believe it or not, I actually had another point to make. So, let me get to that second point. I guess what kind of signals a change in this movie for me is that the best shots in this movie, to me, are pretty consistently in the first half. There's some very good ones in the second half, but in the first half, when it's mostly going in offices and it's kind of sneaking its way around and observing this as a very uninviting, dangerous, portentous place, that to me is so much more effective than someone sitting at a table with a gun shooting it. I mean, for me, the best shot in this movie, the best sequence in this movie, is when they torture someone who they've captured, and Benicio del Toro walks into the room with a big jug of water, and you just know nothing good is going to happen here. And the best shot in the movie is right before that. I believe it's right before that, when it's looking down a hallway at a kind of a diagonal angle, and you see Josh Brolin, who I'm just going to call Josh Brolin because he's basically playing Josh Brolin in this movie, at least my vision of Josh Brolin. He's walking down the hallway, and it's a fixed shot. And then once he sort of catches up to the center of the frame, the camera moves to sort of face straight ahead, and it's facing straight ahead at a door. Next to the door is a guard who's standing there very nonchalantly, and it just kind of looks like an office, but you know something is wrong because of the guard. And then the door opens, and it's this guy, sweaty, disgusting looking, sitting in this chair, clearly not having a good day, and then the door closes. That, for me, is kind of the heart of what I like about this movie, is the danger behind the door. Danger behind the door that otherwise looks banal and ordinary, and it looks like the door that belongs to the people who we trust in the government, or who we're expected to trust, who we should trust, who we want to trust, et cetera, et cetera. That, to me, is a better movie than, again, I keep fixating on this scene with Benicio del Toro towards the end. And then what's funny is that after that scene, there's a really great last scene with him in it. Quite a bit. And it's very beautifully photographed. It's very intelligently photographed. It's communicating a lot with just its shots and glances and gestures.
In that last sequence, without getting into spoilers, was there a moment where the aspect ratio changed for you guys, or was that just in my theater?
I don't recall the aspect ratio change.
Yeah, I can't say.
There's definitely a moment where the screen goes black for a second, so this must have just been a faulty projection. Screen goes black. Comes back, and it's almost 4:3.
Wow, I would have noticed that.
Yeah, strangest thing. Even the curtains came in a little bit in the theater I was in. Yeah.
Yeah, and no, then their automated system must have just glitched.
Had a bit of a stroke. That's kind of funny. I thought that was on purpose, and I was ready to dissect it, but I guess it was a mistake.
I once watched a faulty screener that just straight up didn't have any sound.
Nice.
I thought it was like a choice that the film was making to be completely without sound for the first like 20 minutes.
Yeah, Mark Kermode talked about seeing one of those Mark Tondoroy films, and how they showed the second reel first by accident, and everybody was like, "What's going on?" He's like, "Oh, grow up. They're playing with time." But no, to Nick's point, it's a very strange phenomenon that it's a film that has such impressive and such overpowering and like incredible cinematic stuff in it, and then I don't know, its best parts are so good that they make me forget about how much I would ordinarily dislike its worst parts, which admittedly are like, you know, it's not like they're unforgivable sins or anything. It's just things that I would wish that somebody would have edited out at some point between table read and getting on set.
See,
but
I'm curious to find what you all think are the worst parts.
I agree rather with Nick's sort of distaste for the we'll call it the penultimate scene, because I think that it takes the film into generic territory that I think sort of, I don't know, cheapens the sort of like chilling distanced film we had been watching up until that point, even as far as the tunnel sequence, which again still has that wonderful thing, which is Emily Blunt cannot control what is going on around her. And then we leave her perspective for a different one for a little bit. And again, it's not like the scene isn't really, really, really well handled by director, star, cinematographer, and sound designer. It's just, I think that belongs in a different film, that sequence.
It's a statement about how little Emily Blunt's character understands what she's doing, that is the film that we've been watching.
Yeah.
And it's,
I mean, you know, and
you like her, keep waiting for her moment to happen. And it's just, she's not, she's stuck in a movie that she has no control over. She's not even playing in the right movie.
That's a very generous reading.
That is literally how I read it. I wrote my review under that impression. And I mean, it's funny though. My favorite moment in this whole film is everything from the moment they get in the cars, go over the bridge into Juarez, and then come back.
Yeah,
up to and including the interrogation scene. And we've barely talked about, like, that is just a reverse sequence of just consummate filmmaking.
It is breathtaking. I mean, yeah, you're quite right that whole sequence where they're in the jeeps and they're not jeeps, they're SUVs, but they're very close together. And it's funny, my dad said this to me, that he always gets nervous and stuff like that, because if one car breaks too fast, then the whole thing stops and you can take advantage of everybody in every car. Just, you know, the body's hanging from the overpass, another great little touch, because, and this is sort of endemic of what I think he does really well as a director when he decides to be one, is he doesn't even, that's not even, you know what I mean? That's just a piece of set dressing. That's not a plot point. They just pass that hideous, you know, misanthropic sight and then just keep on going.
Yeah.
And I really wish
a secondary character to get strung up.
Right. Exactly. And it's not, and to his eternal credit, it's just a thing that happens. It's not like a Predator moment where you're waiting for somebody to wind up like that. But yeah, no, that whole sequence was fantastic, and the shootout at the border crossing, you know, really, really well handled, and her being so bent out of shape about the whole thing and confused and out of breath. Just A+ acting from everyone involved. The direction is just surgical in that whole stretch. It really is just marvelous.
Yeah. And I just wanted to get that out there before we get into spoilers. I loved this movie. It's currently, I think, number 3 on my Letterboxd running ranking of the films that I've seen this year.
Uh-huh.
Right after World of Tomorrow and Shaun the Sheep.
What is World of Tomorrow?
The short by Don Hertzfeld.
Oh, of course, of course.
I'm making that one count, because I've watched it enough times for it to count as a feature length.
Is that how that works?
Yeah.
Okay, all right.
Whatever, man. It's my list. I can do what I want.
Yeah, fair enough. If Hoberman can put an episode of The Americans, then you can put a short.
Whoa, did they do that?
Yeah, sure he did.
Really?
And Hoberman also, infamously,
oh, yeah,
1986.
Bears game or something, wasn't it?
The Mets-Red Sox game 6 he put on his list, yeah.
Which is
ironic. Because my top of the year that year was the Super Bowl Shuffle video. So I understand where he was coming from.
I want to. You're gonna have to send me a link to this, because I'm curious. Do you know which episode of The Americans?
I don't. I'm sorry. I don't watch it. I know I should.
Oh, I love that show. Can't wait.
I've heard nothing but great things about it. Sicario right now is sort of just in my 10. I'm kind of wrestling with it versus Magic Mike XXL.
Okay. I've got Shaun the Sheep at number 2, so I really can't pass judgment on anyone, I guess.
You're
but
goddamn right.
The movie's phenomenal, actually. So.
Look, you get back to me when you've seen Shaun the Sheep.
It's great.
You can like both.
Don't
it's not impossible.
Wrong. Yeah, there's nothing wrong with liking both children's movies and, you know, male stripper films. Maybe don't program them together, but you can certainly love them. But actually, Sicario and Magic Mike XXL actually have weirdly similar directorial POVs and distance from subject.
All right, take it easy.
I'm just saying.
We've danced around the two ending scenes enough, so let's get into spoilers.
Finally, gonna tear into this motherfucker.
Yeah, we're gonna tear into it.
Can I swear on your show, by the way?
Oh yeah.
Okay, good.
Yeah, no. We made
this is...
There was one time where I opened up like the episode by like telling people to go f*** themselves. I don't even know why I did it.
As far as film podcasts and swearing goes, this is the right place to break it out.
Fabulous. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, we're not like those other who won't let a guy curse if he wants to. For it.
So you guys, this is the gem saloon of podcasts, is what you're trying to tell me.
Oh, yeah. We're a gem. You know, you want a high-class establishment. Mm-hmm. You can go to the Bell Union. You know where it is.
Oh, man. Excellent.
Anyway.
Deadwood movie. How excited for that are we? Anyway. So, spoilers. We're going to get into spoilers. Yeah.
So we can clear the air and, you know, we'll just explain it right away. What it turns out is that Benicio del Toro is the Sicario, and he is working or is a major part of a Colombian drug cartel, and he finds the leader of the Sonora cartel, I believe is who they're going after in this, and straight up murders him and his whole family.
I don't think he kills him. Does he kill him?
Oh, yeah, he kills him.
Oh, okay, that's
the
right.
The guy says, please not in front of my family.
And he says, prepare to meet God, murders his family.
Yeah.
And
that whole scene was perfect. You know, it wasn't personal. Oh, for me, it is.
Yeah, exactly.
And then he says, not in front of my family. Benicio del Toro is like, nah. And then shoots his kids and his wife in front of him. And then shoots him.
Yeah. I was hoping he was just going to let him sit in it for a little longer. The fact that he murdered his whole family.
Yeah. It's the thing where you want the guy to suffer, but you also want him to die.
Yeah, it's a classic case of suffer or die.
It's a real dilemma that I think everyone among us has gone through now and then.
Yeah, sure.
This is the point where, Nick, I'm sorry I have to bring this up again, but my girlfriend, upon seeing that scene, said, oh, thank God. Because she would, I guess, when he arrived in the house and saw them at the dinner table, she was worried that the film was going to cop out and not have him murder her, that man's entire family. And then was worried that he was going to die first. And she was very happy with the way that scene played out.
Understand.
As was I, but not enough to say, oh, thank God, out loud in the theater. But I loved that scene. It was great. And this is, again, me kind of being completely cool with Denis Villeneuve saying to himself, I've had enough time up here with the high-minded people. It's time to waste some bitches.
It's time to meet God. As he so memorably left in the screenplay.
I know.
But, like, there's a weird thing here, which is I respect the impulse that led him down this avenue. I even think he did a great job directing it. I don't know that the film he was making beforehand wants this plot point. I know that it leads up to that excellent final scene, but I also think that it could very well have just cut from him escaping in the car to him showing up at her apartment.
But you know what else? You know who else didn't want this plot point? Kate Mason. Hey.
I was really worried you were going to say Hitler.
Jesus.
Sorry.
And he does hold back, because I remember thinking, oh, they could have fit another, you know, hero or badass line in there, and they didn't.
No.
There was some restraint.
The badass line comes in the next scene where he says, go move to a little town with law and order. This is a land of the wolves now. You gotta be a wolf to survive, or whatever. That's pretty up there as far as one-liners go.
I don't know. I feel like there might be something about holding a gun that just makes people want to speak that way.
It's entirely possible.
I know I do when I go to the gun range.
Well, that's
my
dark.
My voice drops like a full octave. It gets all gravelly.
All right. So in 4 months after the shooting, this will be played on news broadcasts.
I'm very honored to be here in this piece of police evidence.
At some point, you all will look back on this and go, ah. No, I lack like Kate Macer, I lack the moral fortitude necessary to straight up murder people in cold blood. Which leads us into the actual final scene, which is when Benicio del Toro comes to visit her to get her to sign a document saying that everything they did was on the level. This, of course, is after she's already found out that the only reason she was even invited on this task force is because the CIA needs to be attached to local law enforcement in order to operate domestically. She was just she was literally just a pawn. Just not even a pawn, she was a passport.
Let's be careful how we use the word literally.
Okay. Yeah, all right, fine. She was literally a figurative pawn.
Okay. That's pushing it, but I'll let it go. That was a fairly devastating, you know, reveal. And I don't know. I have a hard time knowing whether or not I, like, can square her going along on that final raid with, like, what I know about her character up until that point. Because it is such a movie thing for somebody to tell one character, oh, P.S., we don't care about you, your life is meaningless, we brought you along for blah, blah, blah. And then they just kind of brush it off and say, I gotta be there. It's the same thing as the found footage character saying, well, I gotta keep filming. Like, I feel like that is the scriptwriter's fault more than it's anybody else's. And it's not like the film doesn't regain its footing after that kind of, I don't know, pig-headed refusal to acknowledge the reality of that situation. But yeah, I really didn't like that bit where she ignores perfectly good excuse to go home from something that she hates. I don't know. I feel like they could have justified that slightly better.
I feel like her character, she still hopes and wants to be an effective part of this team, because she's still frustrated with her old role, which was just rescuing hostages. And she wants to, you know, maybe prove herself to these people who obviously think so little of her, and, you know, affect some kind of change. That does not work out for her. But,
well, yeah, but at that point, she realizes that she's just being used as a tool to further murder people. Like, I feel like that character, with that strong a moral conviction and that strong an opposition to the sort of, I don't know, heedlessness of what Josh Brolin and Benicio del Toro are up to, I feel like she would have just called it a day.
But I think that she thinks their amorality is at, like, maybe a 7. And since she believes that her morality is at, like, a 10, maybe she can, like, at least bump them up to a 3. And I believe that's why she's pointing a gun at Benicio del Toro and says, you know, like, drop your gun, don't, like, and then he just shoots her.
It's true. He does.
I think that she honestly, even at that point, still does not understand the pure, like, anarchic force of will that these men are operating under, that's allowing them to do these incredibly illegal, amoral things. And she,
well, I mean, it's, you know,
change it.
It's essentially a feature-length adaptation of that one speech that Marlon Brando gives in Apocalypse Now, where he talks about being shot in the head with a diamond bullet and all the children's arms getting hacked off. And as that...
Yeah, this is like if someone had heard that and said, oh, you know what, Brando's got a point. Let's give him a whole army.
As if anybody has ever said the words, Brando's got a point. No, you're 100% right. And, you know, as that... It's a very effective bit of filmmaking that essentially to make you understand that in order to exact change, you have to become the most grotesque caricature of a, you know, moral free being, that essentially you have to completely dehumanize your enemy. And again, for all of my complaints, I still think this is a good movie. I can't help myself. I can't help that so much of this film is so effective. And, you know, and I think, you know, to Villeneuve's credit, I think he's getting better, because this isn't a Prisoners or an Ansandi situation where I have to admit everybody else's, like, you know, saying this is a stupid fucking movie. Why do you give it the time of day? You know, this is a film that I see its strengths, because they're overwhelming. They're overpowering. He
right.
did a great fucking job directing this movie. It's just... there's a lot of stuff that I sincerely hope he learns how to, I don't know. I wanted a little more, but I was very happy with what I got. So
and
there's
I,
that.
I agree. Definitely. Because, you know, in Prisoners, I mean, I loved Prisoners, but yeah, I mean, Nick, I can't defend the snakes thing. I don't know why it went there. I don't know why it suddenly became, you know, the last 40 pages of a novel that was written like in 1995. I don't, but I loved it. And
it does kind of feel like 7 fan fiction.
Yeah. Or like it reminded me of like a John Sanford novel, like The Prey.
Okay.
Novels.
Yep.
Yeah. It's just batshit crazy. Like we think we figure everything out. Oh wait, actually it's so much worse than we thought. And we only have 20 minutes to fix it.
Right.
So,
well, it's like one of the Alex Cross things. It's,
yeah,
you know,
precisely.
How sadistically stupid can we get in the last stretch?
It's like an airport book.
Exactly. That's exactly what it is. It's an airport movie. Yeah, and I think he, yeah, well, I fucking loved every, like, you know, I just think he's so good with visuals. He's really, really tuned into sound. I think it's funny that he can't seem to get Radiohead out of his system, because even though he got Johan Johansson to score this, it still feels like Radiohead. I think he does a lot right, and I'm like excited when he does a stretch of 4 or 5 movies that I don't have to apologize for.
I'm looking forward to, I mean, yeah, well, this movie, my reaction comes down to, that's all right. But anyway, two things. One, remember in Prisoners when the people are digging for the missing father of recently kidnapped children in some white trash nightmare home? And they're listening to the most depressing song from a typically depressing band. That was great. Secondly,
you don't think Jake Gyllenhaal brings his Radiohead cassettes with him on every stakeout?
Does Keller Dover appreciate that?
The text on that scene, you know, they rotate albums, and they were like, oh, God, it's Stan's turn to choose. Oh, I swear to God, if he puts on Elliott Smith again.
And then it was either that or Kronos Quartet.
But also,
hey, guys, you're in luck. I brought the soundtrack for Requiem for a Dream.
One last thing is that I feel like he's a director who really lives and dies by thrill, which doesn't mean he doesn't create interesting. I mean, I just pointed out interesting shots that he is making, and I mean, along with Roger Deakins too. These interesting shots that he's creating to tell a story. But I do think he really does depend on his material ultimately. So I am very curious and mostly excited for his Blade Runner thing, which they're not exactly calling a sequel because that's not fashionable anymore, but right, you know, the next universe. Blade Runner installment. Yeah, and yeah, it's in the same universe, and it will feature the one iconic character, not the one iconic character, but you know, the main character from this iconic sci-fi movie, who
he's
is
the
you
only
know,
one
his
that
identity
anybody
is,
cares about returning.
Yeah, exactly. His identity is still debated to this day. No, actually, I was referring to what's that actor's name? Speaking of Deadwood,
Edward James Olmos.
No. Speaking of Deadwood, what's his name?
Oh, God, yeah.
Also in the X-Files episode Blood, if you guys remember that.
That is very specific. Human. I know who you're talking about. He plays...
The guy who plays E.B. Farnham.
Yeah.
Yeah, what is his... He looks like his name is E.B. Farnham. William Sanderson.
William Sanderson.
Very good actor. Anyway,
I'm looking
forward to that.
Or not John Bryan. John Byron? The hell's his name? Leon. He is no longer with us, but I really wish they could find a way to bring him back.
So how did you remember William Sanderson's name in Blade Runner, Brian? J.F. Sebastian.
Which That's is kind name. Of close to E.B. Farnham, weirdly. Yeah.
Anyhow.
What's Sean Young up to? Anybody know?
Oh, God, I don't want to know.
Crazy? I don't know.
That's darker than anything in Sicario, I think. You got a little too much enjoyment laughing at that, I gotta say.
Sorry, I'm remembering all the jokes on the show The Critic about Sean Young, where she's in a commercial as a dancing beer bottle and smashes herself against a table to threaten someone. Classic 90s humor.
God, now I want to watch The Critic.
There's never a bad time to watch The Critic. It's one of the great American sitcoms.
It's got to be streaming somewhere, right?
If not, I have the special edition DVD. You're both welcome to come over and watch it.
I will be there in 4 hours.
Fantastic.
I think I'm just a queue right away, right?
I think so. You're in Astoria now, or you're still in Brooklyn?
No. I'm in Flatbush, Brooklyn. But I'm on the queue.
Yes, know? I am also right off the queue.
All right.
Please, we should
Washington,
stop talking
DC,
about where
so.
We live.
Oh, God, they're going to find us. I guess here's my final question. Just when Benicio del Toro has a gun to her head and is saying you can sign it or you can die.
Right.
She fails that test. She signs it.
Yep.
She now has not even her morality to stand on. She is utterly broken.
What? I don't know if she's utterly broken.
I said she has utterly broken. Like her will broke.
Yeah.
She took a beating from Brolin, but like when the gun was against her head, she signed the paper.
Right.
Nick, do you still disagree?
Oh, no, sure. I thought you said she had
No, I she still had else. Enough. She had enough fortitude to stand up and go point a gun at him, but
then again, did not fire.
Yeah, no, it's true.
Well, also realistically, how do you explain that?
Well, how are they going to explain any of that? Is my problem with that Hollywood logic?
Well, because they're the—I mean, they're the government. They can do anything.
They don't give a shit if it's real or even believable. They just need that damn signature.
Well, understandable. But if they shot her in her apartment, what excuse were they going to give? Well, I guess they could just make it seem like the cartel's got her. I guess I don't know.
Well, it's much easier for her to get shot and explain that away than it is for her to shoot him. You know. Right.
And I don't. There's not a version of this movie that I would believe where she shoots him. But I definitely believe in a movie version of this where she allows herself to be shot.
I sort of thought that's where they were going.
Right.
Which I think is a compliment. I think it's a compliment to the movie, really, ultimately.
That's what that's why I brought it up.
Yeah.
I just was wondering, like, would that have changed the way you looked at the movie, or would it have just been...
No, because it wouldn't... It still wouldn't have changed what structurally it had decided to become. I think I would have walked out feeling sick, which I think would have been to that film's credit for really going to the darkest imaginable place it could go after getting us to sort of like and identify with this character. But I think they weren't going to do that. I don't think this film had any interest in doing that because her point of view was our point of view, and if they killed her, they would have killed the audiences. I think people would have nobody would have walked out of that screening and recommended it to anybody. I don't think that Villeneuve is so in love with Pulp that he would risk his movie failing at the box office, because I really do think that he was being very careful with a film like this with those stars that he knew was going to get a release after Prisoners, because as well I think as Prisoners did, I can't help feeling like there was some pretty toxic word of mouth. And especially now that he's been handed the keys to Blade Runner, yeah. I really don't think he was going to risk fucking that up by murdering America's sweetheart, Emily Blunt.
America's British sweetheart. Did people boo at your screening of The Prisoners? Or just Prisoners?
They didn't boo at my screening. Did they do that at yours?
I remember some people going oh, what the fuck? Come on. But someone told me that people straight up booed at his screening.
Jesus Christ.
I got some of that.
What was people's problem with that? Did they want Keller Dover to be dead?
I think they wanted the movie to end 30 minutes before it did.
Okay, that makes sense. Anyway.
You know there's a really funny moment in this movie when John Bernthal, who of course is great, is in the back of the SUV and he's being tortured in a punishingly realistic way by Benicio del Toro, let's say. And then when he finally breaks, he has two phones and there's something about, which contact is certain, which phone. He says the shitty one. And Benicio del Toro says, oh, this is the shitty one. he's basically saying, I didn't realize you were a judge of aesthetic principles. And it shows Brolin. Shows Brolin in the front just kind of giggling. And it's one of those moments where what's funny about that moment is that I actually don't. That's a moment in a lot of movies where I think it would be played as, these people. Can you believe they're just laughing? Whereas I think the movie is kind of laughing with them at this moment. And I like that it can sort of jump between those. And it doesn't have to be an either or proposition. That was a nice moment. I thought that was an interesting little insert, how you can sympathize with these people. Ultimately, you can sympathize with them more than some of the, the people who are beheading and stringing the bodies in a public square. But that's a moment in particular I thought we should highlight, because just when he goes, oh, this is the shitty phone. I think that's great.
I want to give a special shout out to Jeffrey Donovan.
I was literally about to say that.
Oh, yeah, okay. Wow. I saw his name in the end credits. Who is he?
He's the guy with the glasses in the Juarez street scene.
The one who remarks about the hanging bodies. This is brilliant what they do.
Yeah. He's their Juarez fixer guy.
No memory of that.
He's fucking great. I love him.
He took what I like to call the Guy Pierce role.
Yes,
Guy Pierce in for 2 days and just make him do something weird with his hair.
Yeah, very much. He's doing, it's like Animal Kingdom or Traitor or any of those films where he shows up to lend his name to the film and get it a little better release than it would have gotten. No, I thought he did a marvelous job. I love him anyway. I really think that he someday somebody is going to wise up and ask him to play the devil, and he's going to win an Oscar for it. I think he's fabulous.
Like, this is a weird question. What do you like him in?
I like him in Changeling. Okay. I think he does great work in that. As a man who says the same thing in every scene, but still you don't get sick of him. I liked him on Burn Notice, which is like,
okay,
you know,
that's what I was hoping you'd say. I love him on Burn Notice.
I think he's great on that. And obviously Hitch. No, I'm kidding. I've never seen Hitch.
J. Edgar playing Bobby Kennedy.
That's right.
Also funny, really funny in Clint Eastwood's Changeling as the South Park level detective who just does not believe any compelling evidence that Angelina Jolie gives. I haven't seen that movie since it came out 7 years ago, but I still remember when there's no way that she's making this up. Like, it's obvious that this is going on, and he says over the phone, "Well, she's obviously made up some cock and bull story to get out of raising her son."
Right. I love that. Because he's so, he went through all that trouble of finding a strange boy to give her.
he's the lead detective on South Park is in that movie.
Yeah, basically.
You know, he's playing another Kennedy in the movie LBJ.
Is he? Which one?
He is playing, I just saw this and I clicked on it.
Is he Teddy? I hope he's Ted.
John F.
Oh.
He's playing JFK, huh?
He's probably going to play for 5 minutes before he gets shot in the head.
Very, very probably. I think he's just like a wee bit too interesting looking to play JFK. Like, JFK's face was like sculpted butter or something.
JFK
was just like, I don't know. Like, I feel like he would have been the easiest guy for like half of the SNL cast to play. Because they all have that kind of
saying what we're all thinking about JFK's bland good looks.
They're just like, I don't know. The only reason they're specific is because he was president. Like, can we talk about that? He's just a handsome dude. He's like a Ken doll.
Upset about this.
Now, if you guys want to talk about the lone gunman theory for a bit, you can stick around.
How much time do we have to talk about how we all know who really fired from the grassy knoll that day?
I'm a big proponent of the lone gunman theory. So we can talk about that at some point.
I think it was Dick Cavett, personally, who thought that by doing that and getting LBJ in office, his guest roster would become a little more interesting for that season.
What the fuck? What are we even talking about anymore?
I think this is a great sign that the show has reached its end.
Yeah, natural ending point reached.
I think Josh Brolin's character knows the true story behind the JFK assassination.
He does.
I'm just waiting for Michael Bay to make The Rock 2, which obviously will involve the JFK assassination. Because
do you mean the other conspiracy movie, 13 Hours, Secret Soldiers of Benghazi?
That's going to be great, isn't it?
I cannot wait for that.
I'm very excited.
The last scene of The Rock is Nicolas Cage's character looking at the microfilm and saying, "Honey,
hey, honey, do you want to know who killed JFK?"
Yeah.
And he's looking at a picture of famous television personality Dick Cavett, and I think we're all just too afraid to admit it.
So we all agree that Sicario is well worth it. It is in theaters now, going wide this Friday. And check out the rest of Villeneuve's filmography. It's all very good. Not talking about what's coming to Blu-ray and everything, because that is a full week away, so who cares? We got like one or two more podcasts coming out between now and then, so take a look for those. We should have The Martian up in a couple days. Until then, gentlemen, let us tell the fine people at home where they can find us online. Guest first.
All right, well, thank you, guys. I'm on Twitter at @honors_zombie. I'm on Fandor from time to time. I have a series up on Mubi's Notebook, which I'm very excited about. That just started on Monday. I'm doing New York Film Festival coverage for RogerEbert.com. By the time you listen to this, my latest Unloved will be out. And I write for Brooklyn Magazine like once a week. So I'm everywhere. Good luck getting rid of me.
Herpes.
That's right.
All right, Nick Newman.
You can find Scout and me sitting in the fourth row of the second section of New York's Walter Reed Theater for the New York Film Festival pretty much every day for the next week and a half. And you can also
You're
find
all
me
about giving people very specific instructions on
Nick really wants our stalkers to find us.
You can find me also on thefilmstage.com, twitter.com/Nick_Newman, and having sex with my hitman.
I'm not even going to explain it.
Nope.
Neither should you.
I'm not. I'm just going to internalize it and then say that I too can be found on the film stage. Remember again to look out for our review of The Martian, which will be up soon. Twitter.com/BrianJRowan, my personal site, dearfilm.net, and that's pretty much it. So, ladies and gentlemen at home, thank you for listening, and tune in next time.